From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. That rain that brought deadly flooding and mud flows to Montecito in Southern California is now over. But the search for the missing continues. At least 15 people have died. Those numbers are expected to rise. 50 were rescued by helicopter. Search teams pulled a baby from the muck and revived her. Officials predicted this could happen because of the Thomas Fire on December 4th, the largest wildfire in California history, which scorched the region. An official ordered evacuations, but only an estimated 10 to 15% left. Lance Orozco is news director at KCLU. He's in the area in Santa Barbara County. Lance, what are you seeing?
Well, Robin, I'm actually in the foothills near where the mudslide started in an area called Toro Canyon. Huge, huge boulders the size of cars. And you can see, you know, the force of this. It just basically tore rocks and other debris from the mountainside and pulled it down into this community. In Montecito, there's basically, you've got some beautiful houses that are right up against the mountains, and then steep slopes, and then about 6 miles down from there is the ocean. So it's basically mountains, these beautiful houses and mansions and ranches, and then the ocean itself. So the water just tore through here in a path all the way down to the ocean, closing a main coastal highway as well as causing the death and destruction in Montecito itself.
Yeah, terrible. And you say beautiful homes. Oprah Winfrey, Rob Lowe, Ellen DeGeneres live in this area. We've spoke to firefighters who are battling the wildfires around December 4th about that, heard about that. Oprah has tweeted out that her home is okay. But boy, the devastation. I mean, people are describing this mud moving cars, moving the debris that was left from the fires.
It did. The force of it is incredible. And one firefighter told me that normally, if the rain occurred in the mountains in the ridge above Montecito, it would take about a day for the water to work its way down. But because the slopes have been stripped bare, it moves in 15 minutes. Mm. So there's really no way to even predict it accurately when something like that happens. It comes and it roared through here. And even though people knew there was a danger, it just came through here before they could do anything to really alert people.
And this was about 3 o'clock in the morning when it happened. What are people saying? I mean, we've heard descriptions, you know, it sounded like a freight train. What are people saying that heard it?
A lot of people said they heard a roar first, and I think a lot of it was because there was some very, very heavy rainfall that preceded it. And so they heard the roar, and they knew that something was up, but I think nobody pictured it was going to be something of this scale. People are used to getting heavy rain in this area from time to time, but just nobody thought it was going to turn into something like this. And then some people describing it, I think, like you said, as a freight train coming through, and then boom, it was there.
Yeah. Look, there was the warning. And people in California, as you know about mudslides further south. The PCH is constantly closed because of boulders tumbling down and mudslides coming down. They knew that the fires had scorched, denuded the mountainside. I mean, why didn't more people leave?
First of all, you know, the Thomas Fire burned for more than a month. It started on December 4th, and technically it's technically not out now. It's still technically at 92% containment, although this rainfall obviously is going to help with the final containment. But a lot of people in this area of Montecito were out of their homes for around 2 weeks. So they had evacuated for 2 weeks, and then they got this new evacuation order. And even though authorities were very, very vocal about it, they had a news conference last Friday, and then the Monday, the day before the storm hit, they said, okay, everybody, you know, mandatory evacuations for part of Montecito and the rest of Montecito, voluntary evacuation orders. They were very clear that there was a big danger, and they said the storm's going to be big. A lot of people were just, I think, burned out on the whole evacuation thing, and they said, no, we don't see flames, we don't see smoke. And they didn't sense the danger, I think, the same way that you do with a brush fire.
Yeah, they're calling it evacuation fatigue. Well, but now, so many deaths, so many more expected. People must be shell-shocked.
People are very shocked. I think a lot of people think this couldn't happen here. And, you know, disasters can happen anywhere. But Montecito, again, it's like as I stand here and I look at the foothills, and it's almost surreal because it's sunny. There's just some light clouds. You wouldn't know. If you looked in the wrong direction, you wouldn't know that anything was wrong. And there's just these beautiful mansions and estates, and it seems like a very idyllic lifestyle here. And it is, except for when disaster hits.
Yeah. Lance Orozco, news director of KCLU in Montecito in Santa Barbara County, the site of terrible, deadly mudslides. Lance, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Let's go now to Washington, where President Trump is calling the American judicial system, quote, broken and unfair. That's after a federal judge in California blocked the administration from ending the so-called DACA program. DACA protects some young immigrants who came to the country illegally as children. It protects them from being deported. President Obama began the program in 2012, but President Trump ordered it to stop last year. DACA had been slated to end in March. So what happens now? USA Today reporter Alan Gomez joins us now from Miami. Hi there, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
A number of plaintiffs had sued the Trump administration for stopping the DACA program. They argued that the president didn't take proper steps in halting it. So what was the judge's rationale last night in keeping the program going?
What the judge ruled was that the legal foundation that the administration used to end DACA was flawed. Basically, back in September, when the administration announced that they were ending DACA, Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the Department of Homeland Security argued that President Obama was wrong when he created DACA. They said that he had overstepped his legal authority and thus the program was illegal. So they came back and said, this is an illegal program, so we're shutting it down. What Judge Alsup said was, no, DACA absolutely is a legal program. The legal foundation for ending it was flawed. Thus, the administration has to restart it and has to go back and get the program going again.
Okay. Well, several thousand DACA recipients have already lost their protections because they hadn't renewed on time. What does this court ruling mean for them?
For them, it's really hard right now. Immigration advocacy groups are not telling DACA recipients, hey, hurry up, run out there and put in your application, get your renewals going, because this ruling is a good victory for them. They're all very excited that the judge ruled the way that he did. But a lot of them think this is going to be very short-lived. The Department of Justice could appeal very quickly, and they have a favorable majority at the Supreme Court. They could also decide to just cut this announcement and give a new reason for ending DACA, which would put them right back in limbo. So while all those legalities are figured out, these advocacy groups are telling their folks, look, just hold off for a little bit. We're not sure what's going on. Let the legal process play out a little bit before you start sending in your applications again to the government.
I see. So still kind of a state of limbo then for the larger group of maybe some 700,000 people who could start losing their protections in March, or could have, as you said, Alan. We don't exactly know what's going to happen next. But I do want to ask you, this ruling comes right smack dab in the middle of the fact that Congress is trying to reach a deal on DACA before it would have expired in March. So what's your sense on how the judge's ruling could affect congressional efforts?
What the message that's coming from the immigration advocacy groups, from Democrats in Congress, Chuck Schumer just a little while ago on the House floor, on the Senate floor, was talking about this, that the ultimate solution needs to be Congress finding that long-term solution. All these lawsuits, and there are other lawsuits against the president's decision, all of them could be short-lived, all of them could be temporary. I think a lot of people understand that a president ultimately has the power to start and end programs created by the executive branch. So there's no long-term resolution. They don't feel comfortable going the legal route to protect all these undocumented immigrants. So they're pushing Congress to continue negotiating with Republicans to find that long-term solution, because that, in their view, is the only way that these dreamers are going to get the sort of long-term reassurance that they need that they can stay in the country. They don't want them just lingering and waiting for court decision after court decision. You remember very well everything we went through with the travel ban last year. One court would say one thing, another would say another. And so I think they want Congress to just finally get together, pass this thing, and provide that long-term relief for these dreamers.
Okay, interesting. So a point of agreement there then, a bipartisan agreement that a legislative solution is the best way regarding DACA. But just got under a minute here, Alan. On that point, you know, there was that remarkable meeting between Democrats and Republicans and President Trump about immigration yesterday. One of my takeaways from that is that the two parties are still really far apart in terms of what they'd like to see in any kind of bill, and that they don't have that much time to act.
Exactly. And that was one of the things. I mean, I think a lot of folks watched that meeting and came away thinking, wow, look, they're talking. They seem to be in the ballpark. They seem to be talking on the same page. But, you know, as somebody who's tracked immigration negotiations for years, what I heard was Senator Dianne Feinstein talking about we want a clean Dreamer bill to only protect them. I heard Representative Bob Goodlatte saying that he has this very long laundry list of demands to improve border security, interior immigration enforcement, meant to change the legal immigration system. And so, yeah, there was a lot of talk and there was a lot of optimism after that meeting. But when the negotiators go back and start talking, they're still very, very far apart. Yeah. So finding any resolution and closing that gap is going to be very difficult.
That's USA Today's Alan Gomez. Alan, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Lori Simmons is a very successful, internationally recognized artist. Her work is at the Museum of Modern Art, the Guggenheim, the Whitney. Oh, and she's also Girls creator Lena Dunham's mom and played her artist mother in Lena's 2010 film Tiny Furniture. Lena plays a college grad who comes back home to her mom's exasperation.
Candace said the place reeked of pot.
That was not my fault. There's no way that was my fault. You know that there's a kid across the air shaft who smokes a ton of weed and will never wave at Nadine.
Okay, but you didn't drink the wine. Who drank the wine? This is Charlotte. I think Charlotte is such an incredibly bad influence.
Now, Lori Simmons has made her own film, again playing an artist, and Lena has a cameo in it. Lori Simmons wrote and directed My Art and stars as Ellie Shine, a longtime art professor whose own work has been somewhat stalled. Here's how she describes her art to another artist friend, played by Blair Brown.
It's still like excerpts from a visual diary. It's still stuff about memory and longing, nostalgia.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to work with those old movies that I know you hate. You hate them.
No, I love it. I love your art mind. I own your work, right? And I adored your last show. I really adored it. It was a while ago, but you have been looking for something new since then.
Ellie finally gets the opportunity to explore her artist mind when she house sits for a friend in upstate New York. My Art opens in New York this week. It'll be on demand at the end of the month. And Lori Simmons joins us. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Well, I have to say, the art that she finds, well, how would you describe it? Because I want to set that up first, and then we can back up a bit.
I would say it's kind of a performance art, but really what she's doing is recreating some of her favorite scenes from her favorite movies, but doing them shot by shot. And the thing that makes them sort of unique or performative is the fact that Ellie is a 65-year-old woman who's essentially dressing up in costume and acting like her childhood movie heroines, Kim Novak, Marilyn Monroe, and even a few men sneak in there. She cross-dresses in A Clockwork Orange.
There was me, that is Alex, and my three droogs, that is Pete, Georgie, and Dim. And we sat in the Corova Milk Bar trying to make up our risuttocks, what to do with the evening.
Fantastic shot there. It's sort of like a Cindy Sherman kind of artist who embodies the characters in the film and recreating the film.
I would say that's true. And for me, the hardest part of writing the story, and parenthetically, writing a story was such a new experience for me, was trying to figure out what kind of art Ellie would make. And the art needed to be appealing to the audience, something they could watch, because watching painting on screen is literally like watching paint peel. And, of course, Cindy is a colleague and a friend, and there is a sense of an homage to her work and the way that she's represented herself as a number of different female characters across the course of her career.
Yeah. Let's listen to a scene from the beginning of My Art. And here's Ellie Shine, your character, speaking with one of her former art students, who is your daughter, Lena Dunham, full of complaints about all the success she's having. Let's listen.
Basically, so I'm in the Biennale.
Oh, great.
So I have to be in Europe between my two installations. Oh. But then I've got the fall show at my New York gallery, so any moment I'm not there, I'm in my studio, which means I can't spend any time on the North Fork with my boyfriend, which is, like, just this whole other mess because he's feeling so neglected in all these different ways. And so, like, I wouldn't schedule a fall show again. I think it's brutal.
Oh, that sounds brutal.
Which, of course, it doesn't to your character, who would die to have any one of those problems. Can we just talk for a second about having your daughter, Lena, play that kind of tone-deaf character? Because that was sometimes what she would do in her character in Girls, kind of be kind
right.
of self-involved.
Right. Well, that particular exercise is something that the late comedian Harris Whittles coined the term the humble brag. So many good things are happening to you, and it's just so taxing and exhausting. And I think I was so, when we shot that, I think I was so stunned at how well Lena did it. I don't know if I was acting there. I was genuinely shocked. When I said that sounds brutal, it wasn't in the script. I was just sort of stunned. And I think that's something that former students often do to their teachers or mentors, because they assume that those people will always be happy for them, never thinking about what might be going on in their lives.
So what are you saying? You are an artist. You play an artist mom in Tiny Furniture. You play a determinedly single female artist in My Art. What were some of the things about female artists you were trying to get across?
Well, I think that me and my artist friends have always had difficulty with seeing the way that artists are portrayed on screen, because it's either over-dramatized, mythologized, trivialized, we're caricatured. And I had this idea that I really wanted to present the kind of day-to-day life of an artist who's in the process of making their art, and show that there are really mundane moments, boring moments, a couple of muse moments. So I had that on my mind. But the other thing, more importantly, was that I wanted to represent women around my age who seem very okay with their lives. They wish for more work success, or perhaps every once in a while wish that they had a boyfriend if they were single. But those are not the driving forces. I feel like the women I know are living in the moment, appreciating their lives. And I felt like there was a real dearth of women characters like that on screen. Mm-hmm. So that got into my head as well.
Well, because your character, Ellie Schein, her real concern, as she's holed up in this gorgeous upstate New York home, her real concern is her artwork. There's a constellation of men who start to revolve around her. Two gardeners, one's an older, out-of-work actor, maybe moving away from that. The other is a young, hungry actor. Then there's a student's stepdad. They all start competing for her attention. She seems far more interested in making her art, and she starts incorporating them in that. It's like they're the flies and she's got the spider web. Let's listen to one of the scenes. Robert Clohessy is, I mentioned the gardener. He's enlisted by Ellie Schein to play Clark Gable to her Marilyn Monroe in The Misfits.
What makes you so sad? I think you're the saddest girl I ever met.
You're the first man that's ever said that to me. Usually I'm told I'm happy.
Well, that's because you make a man feel happy.
I don't feel that way about you, Gay.
I love the fact that it's the film The Misfits, and here you have these two people, one's not satisfied with how big her art life is, the other's thinking of quitting acting. And they do a really great job on that scene.
They do a good job on the scene, but I think that I do about as good a job as an artist can do who's doing performance art.
Okay, he does a good job.
I think I can only imagine, you know, what that scene would be in the hands of an experienced actress. But that was really important to me, that the scenes were only as good as an artist who was interested in performance art could do. And that's very specific.
But it gives these other misfit actors a chance to shine.
Right, exactly. And all of the characters that Ellie engages all have a kind of dissatisfaction with what they're doing, a kind of wish for more or something different. And that's not necessarily just a product of age. It's more like a place you can be in your life at any time in your life.
We mentioned Lena's appearance. We have to mention another family appearance. We see a painting, by the way, from your husband, Carol Dunham, hanging in the gallery in the first scene. Your other daughter, Grace, is seen at a gallery opening. But I'm referring to your dog, Dean.
Oh, Dean.
I know. We can't. We have to be careful here about the ending. But he has one of those, what is it, that his back legs won't work?
It's called degenerative myelopathy. He was basically losing the use of his back legs, and it would have, you know, traveled through his entire body. But I shot a lot of those scenes before I actually started to shoot the movie, because I found his gait so beautiful and so tender and so touching. And of course, yes, I was madly in love with my dog. And I knew that this movie that was brewing in my mind, I knew that he would have a place in it. So I shot as much of him as I could, knowing that he might not be around for the actual movie shoot.
Well, and there is something so Charlie Chaplin, you know,
yeah,
about
that's lovely.
Watching these dogs from behind when they love you so much and they're trying to run to you, but nothing's working. And
slipping and sliding.
Oh,
and he's a pretty good actor.
So seeing, I don't know, it's maybe seeing the art in everything, including a dog's gait.
Mm-hmm.
But you've explained that painting would not have been a good choice, you think, as a filmmaker, because it's not something people would watch.
Mm-hmm.
Was it also about not wanting to do your artwork?
Well, Ellie is not me, and
right.
It was really important for me to find an artwork that could be Ellie's. My art is the movie that I made, but it's also about Ellie's art. So I had to find a place to go where people could respond to it as something realistic that Ellie might do. And the other thing I thought about is how every artist I know, to a one, is a cinephile. Artists love movies. I mean, more recently, I would say artists love television. But basically, everyone I know is watching something all the time, and they really fancy themselves pretty much cinematic experts. So the idea that an artist like Ellie would have an obsession with old movies seemed perfectly reasonable and realistic to me.
Yeah. That's Lori Simmons, the writer, director, and star of the new movie, My Art. Lori, thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, it's so great to talk to you. I'm completely thrilled.
Thank you. My Art comes out on DVD and on demand on January 30th, but you can check out the film's take on A Clockwork Orange and the Misfits at hereandnow.org. I'm Robin Young, co-host with Jeremy Hobson of Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. We cover the day's most essential news with analysis and context so you know the why and the what's next. Plus authors, artists, people making a difference. It's a fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
One of the hallmark provisions of the Affordable Care Act was the option for states to expand Medicaid. That extends health insurance to low-income Americans. Now, 32 states chose to include this option. 18 states declined. Now, a new study published in the journal Health Affair reports that those non-expansion states have suffered a spike in hospital closures, while the states that expanded Medicaid saw their hospital closure rates decline. Joining us is Casey Ross, National Hospitals Correspondent for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Hi there, Casey.
Hi.
Well, first of all, tell us more about the study's findings. I mean, how much of a spike in hospital closures are we talking about?
Well, the study found that hospitals in Medicaid expansion states are 84% less likely to close than hospitals in non-expansion states. Essentially, the rate of closures ticked up in non-expansion states by about one or two hospitals a year, while it slowed in states that did not expand Medicaid.
What are the reasons, then, specifically for the hospital closures in the non-Medicaid expansion states?
Well, those states did not benefit from the addition of hundreds of thousands of insured patients under the Medicaid program. So those hospitals are susceptible to the financial pressures that had existed in the industry over the long term, and primarily those were exacted by large numbers of uninsured patients in their community who cannot pay their hospital bills. So they seek care and the hospital has to hospitals provide that care, but then don't get reimbursed for their treatment. And that just significantly undermines their bottom line and makes it a lot harder to stay in business.
I see. Well, the researchers also found that rural regions were affected most by these closures. I mean, tell us a little bit more about that.
So hospitals that are located in rural communities just are operating on thinner margins to begin with. The populations that surround them tend to have higher rates of unemployment and poverty, and they also tend to be older. So those hospitals rely more heavily on Medicare and Medicaid. And without the expansion of insured Medicaid patients, you just struggle more to stay afloat. It just becomes harder to make the numbers work.
Well, finally, Casey, I'm wondering if we could think about what the future may hold, because congressional Republicans are pushing to make major changes to Medicaid, possibly even undoing the Medicaid expansion that we're talking about. I mean, what effect, if that happens, what effect would it have?
Well, if Republicans succeed in undoing the Medicaid expansion, it's going to mean that hospitals all across the country are going to have fewer insured patients in their communities, which means that their levels of uncompensated care, care that they provide that goes unpaid, is going to increase, and that's going to place significant pressure on those hospitals financially. So I think what you're going to see is across the country, there are going to be more hospitals that are closing just the way they are now in non-expansion states. You're going to have, you know, impaired access to healthcare services in communities around the country. And I think it'll have a disproportionate impact on rural communities. Those communities are really going to struggle to keep their hospitals open.
Well, Casey Ross writes about national hospital issues for STAT. Casey, thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Republicans are outraged at Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein's decision to release transcripts of a lengthy interview with the author of that dossier, the one that made allegations about President Trump's connections to Russia during the 2016 campaign. You'll remember initially an anti-Trump Republican donor commissioned the political research firm Fusion GPS to do the research on candidate Trump, not uncommon. When it looked like he might win, they dropped out. The Clinton campaign and the DNC picked up payments. The dossier relied on a series of memorandums from former British spy Christopher Steele. Glenn Simpson, founder of Fusion GPS, took questions about the dossier from the Senate Judiciary Committee back in August. He wanted his testimony released, but the 300-page transcript did not become public until yesterday, when Feinstein, the top Democrat on the committee, defied her Republican colleagues by publishing it. This morning, the president called the investigation a witch hunt and Feinstein's decision to release the testimony a disgrace. But defenders of the release say it shows the Republican members of the committee were more interested in attacking the source of the research than learning about Russian involvement in the campaign. NPR's national security advisor, or editor, Phil Ewing, is here to advise us. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Robin.
So take that up first. People can now read it for themselves. You've read much of it. Is the questioning skewed along partisan lines?
It's a very kind of dry legal deposition. If you actually go to our website, npr.org, and bring up this transcript, which you could do if you wanted to spend a couple of hours, these are attorneys for the Senate Judiciary Committee asking attorneys for Glenn Simpson, whom you just talked about, and Simpson personally, these questions about who he is, how his business works, what types of work he takes on, and specifically the case that you described in 2015 when people in the Republican world were marshaling about the primary and determining who was going to be the party's nominee for president the following year, 2016. They came to him and said, we want dirt on Donald Trump. This is a common practice in Washington, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, the dark arts, as it's called, so-called oppo research. And that's what Glenn Simpson does, except in this case, the oppo that he commissioned this former British intelligence officer to do took a very unexpected turn.
Well, and Simpson says that Christopher Steele, that former British intelligence officer, contacted the FBI himself because he was concerned that candidate Trump was being blackmailed by the Russians. And Simpson further says the FBI told him they'd already had reason to investigate Trump's possible ties to Russia before the dossier was released. Tell us more about what Simpson said about that.
That's right. According to this testimony, first of all, his dossier, these memoranda from Steele based on his sources in Russia, were not the germ of the FBI's counterintelligence investigation into potential ties between the Trump camp and this concerted effort undertaken by the Russian government to attack the election in 2016. So that's point number one. Point number two is Steele himself, according to Simpson, and this and his word is the basis for these conclusions, and so we have to take them as witness testimony as opposed to established fact. But what he says is Steele was so surprised by what he uncovered as he was running these traps inside of Russia that he felt an obligation to report what he was learning to U.S. law enforcement authorities. The comparison that Simpson makes in his testimony was, you know, you're driving to work in the morning, you see a car accident. For the instinct of a lot of people, you want to call 911 and tell the authorities what you saw and have the paramedics come, have the police come, etc. And it was that impulse in his telling telling that motivated Steele's outreach to the FBI. Again, Simpson's testimony per this transcript is our basis for that. We haven't heard from Steele himself publicly, and so we'll just have to see whether we do, and if so, what he says.
Well, the Washington Post reports that in this tale that Simpson tells, he was referring to an Australian official who contacted U.S. officials with concerns about a conversation in London with Trump advisor George Papadopoulos. Now, he has pled guilty to lying to the FBI. He's cooperating in this investigation. But is that confirmed, that this germ of this investigation for the FBI came from Australian officials and it was concern about Papadopoulos?
The short answer is no. We know that based on that New York Times story, the former foreign policy advisor Papadopoulos, according to the New York Times, got drunk in London and told an Australian diplomat there that he had been receiving these overtures from Russian agents about dirt on Hillary Clinton and other help, and that way made its way through official channels from Australia's foreign ministry to the United States. We know, of course, about this Steele dossier because it's dominated a lot of the discussion this year, and there are probably other threads and germs based on things the U.S. intelligence community might have been seeing, based on the way that they were aware about people who were in Trump world in 2015 and 2016 that also might have brought this to their attention. But right now, we don't have anything that ties all the threads together except for the fact that no one thing appears to have been what sprung the mousetrap and got the FBI to start this investigation.
Well, briefly, what about Steele's concerns, fears that Trump was being blackmailed by the Russians? Is that at all confirmed?
That's not confirmed. And, you know, NPR has not detailed at that level the things that are in this dossier because it remains unverified. The dossier is out there. It was released just about a year ago by BuzzFeed in a completely uncensored version. So people can read it. And a lot of us remember the kind of things that it says. But we at this time don't have any independent basis to judge how reliable the things in it are. It could be misinformation from the Russian government. It could be mistakes that sources made, et cetera. Right now, we just don't know.
And what about the release of the transcripts? It said it was to counter a move that Republicans made last week when they made a criminal referral to the Justice Department to investigate Christopher Steele for possibly lying to the FBI. This was sort of a tit-for-tat on that. What is that about?
The politics here are advantageous to the Republican majorities in Congress because they control a lot of the process, these interviews, the material, including transcripts like this, that is generated as they do these investigations. And when there are things that are officially secret, they have the ability to talk about them or leak details about them to the press without the public being able to see the full version of what's under discussion. And the tactical victory, if you want to think about it in that way, that Feinstein and her supporters say that she got with the release of this transcript is taking away that edge in the case of the Simpson testimony. Now, on that criminal referral, Senator Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and Senator Graham, who's one of its top subcommittee chairmen, they have secret information about what they say Steele may or may not have done. They allege that he gave false information at some point along the line, and that was the basis of this so-called criminal referral to the Justice Department. We don't know the details about that because it's all secret, and the FBI and the National Security Agency are not going to talk about them because they never talk about such secret information. So that card is still available for Republicans to play. But in the case of Feinstein in this transcript, she's taken it away from them.
Phil Ewing, National Security Editor for NPR. We'll link you to the transcripts also at hereandnow.org. Phil, thanks.
Thank you.
In Texas, a number of civil rights groups are angry over the inclusion of Governor Greg Abbott as an honorary grand marshal of a parade to honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Christopher Connolly from member station KERA explains.
Dominique Alexander from the Dallas-based Next Generation Action Network said he was shocked when he heard that Texas Governor Greg Abbott was given top billing at the festivities.
We will not tolerate this, and we call for an effective boycott of the North Texas Martin Luther King Parade.
The NAACP chapter in nearby Arlington, Texas, also decried Abbott's inclusion. The group is convening a town hall on how to respond and released a statement saying that Abbott has, quote, done more to damage and undermine African-American and Latino civil and voter rights, educational opportunities, and economic empowerment than any other modern-day Texas governor. Jeff Hood, a pastor and activist, said Martin Luther King stood up for the rights of poor and marginalized people and that they should be front and center in the parade.
Right now, with Greg Abbott being the grand marshal, We don't have a keeper of the dream, we have a killer of the dream.
A parade spokeswoman says Abbott was invited as the top elected official in Texas, and that part of King's legacy is engaging with people even when you don't agree with them. She said participation shouldn't be seen as an endorsement of any particular policies. A spokeswoman for the governor said Abbott looks forward to honoring Dr. King, and that, quote, it's a shame that some are politicizing what should be a unifying event.
This is no politics. I am at odds with the governor's policies.
Ruby Faye Woolridge is an Arlington community activist who's running for Congress. She says Abbott's support for voter ID laws and gerrymandered districts undermine the voting power of people of color.
Those policies, along with him not expanding Medicaid, those things hurt the African-American community. Let's be clear about that.
Woolridge says she hopes that if Abbott does take part in the parade, he'll also sit down with civil rights leaders and community groups to talk about the impact of his policies. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Connolly in Fort Worth.
RCA Studio B is no longer the hit factory it was when it opened 60 years ago in Nashville, but some modern musicians are still recording there, seeking the signature sound that helps spur the careers of artists like Elvis Presley. According to the people who run Studio B, it's those new artists and a steady stream of tourists who are keeping that sound alive today. Jason Moon Wilkins from member station WPLN reports.
This fall, J.D. McPherson scored a number one on the Americana charts with his song Lucky Penny, recorded at Studio B.
This lucky penny's been nothing but bad luck.
60 years ago, a song by Don Gibson became the first number one country hit ever recorded in the Nashville music icon.
I can't get over how she set me free.
These two recordings are connected by a unique tone that echoes through the tracks and across time. Studio B's reverb chamber sits above the iconic building and has heard the voices of Elvis Presley, Dolly Parton, and Roy Orbison all bounce around its walls.
When I first saw you, with your smile so tender, my heart was captured.
A new ladder outside allows studio manager Justin Croft to show off the space few people ever see.
Basically, we're looking at a relatively small room, and you've got some curvy walls, and the real thing that impacts it, though, is just how hard these surfaces are. And that's what makes it reflective. It makes it have this reverb-y kind of sound. So, you know, anything that has reverb on it was the sound of this room. So you're talking about the first Elvis stuff and the first Everly stuff that they did here. So, like, Dream is this.
When I feel blue in the night and I need you to hold me tight.
The Everly Brothers' Dream is one of the classics heard on daily tours of Studio B. Croft says some special groups end their tour by doing a quick recording session using some of the same equipment once employed by legendary artists.
You know, we're very much a living, breathing, open 7 days a week, you know, fully functional studio. And the things that are here, instruments, microphones, some of the gear we have, you know, if you don't use it, it sort of starts to break down. So by using it, you keep it going. You keep it alive. It's almost like if you put, say, our piano, right? If you put that great Steinway in a case, you know, it's almost like putting it in a coffin, you know? It's like, it's over.
When J.D. McPherson was allowed to make his new album at Studio B, he used some of that historic gear, including the piano. Sitting in a vintage chair in the lounge behind the control room, McPherson refers to the building as if it had a voice in how his songs turned out.
There was one song that Ray Basildo, our keyboard player, and I wrote here that wouldn't have existed in any other studio. It kind of had to be in there. It was called Jubilee. And that song was directly informed by that piano, that room, what it felt like to be in that room. And that's one that really sticks out to me, as the actual song wouldn't have occurred anywhere else.
I hang around where the music's playing. I see the joyful look on every face.
In order to use the studio, McPherson had to record after tourists were done for the day, setting up in the evening and tearing down sometimes at sunrise. He says his band was inspired by the restrictions and their surroundings, but not necessarily in the way that he expected.
That's the strange thing about this experience. Was the first day when we loaded in, we had a song ready to go, and in my mind, we were going to make a song that sounded like it came out of a classic Studio B session with, you know, big timpani drums and all kinds of, like, orchestration and stuff. And I'll just say, the longer we were here, the louder and fuzzier everything got. I don't know, it's almost like, I don't know if it was us or the building, something wanted to go slightly irreverent.
Desperate love.
McPherson says it's a miracle that Studio B still exists. But some of the other buildings along Nashville's famed Music Row feel more threatened now than ever. There are still recording studios and music businesses up and down the street, but those are slowly being surrounded by glass-walled condos and high-end hotels. McPherson says even in the era of home studios, he sees the value of saving spaces that have stories.
There's another very old studio that's still standing that's not being used right now in town, and I've driven by that more than once and trying to figure out, how can somebody get this thing going again? It happens every day. Something is owned by somebody that wants to do something else with the property, and it goes away. But, you know, if I had the Van Halen bucks, I'd buy them all up and get them all running again.
For Here and Now, I'm Jason Moon Wilkins in Nashville.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.